Just the Taste. I'm Scott Curry with Chef's Best. We gather and talk about the trends in marketing, retail, and production in food and beverage that are shaping the industry. Joining us today is food marketing expert, Phil Lemper. For more than 25 years, Phil, an expert analyst on consumer behavior, marketing trends, new products, and changing retail landscape, has identified and explained impending trends to consumers in some of the most prestigious companies worldwide. Known as the supermarket guru, Lempert is a distinguished author and speaker who alerts customers and business leaders to those corporate trends and empowers them to make educated purchasing and marketing decisions. He founded supermarketguru.com in 1994. He is the founder and editor of the Lempert Report, Food, Nutrition, and Science, Facts, Figures, and the Future, and the Food Journal. He's been profiled and interviewed by a whole host of publications, including USA Today, New York Times, The Christian Science Monitor, Wall Street Journal, Forbes, Newsweek, Ad Age, and is interviewed by hundreds of publications each year. He is also a columnist for Forbes.com. The list goes on and on and on, and I think you all get the idea. Phil, thank you very much for joining the podcast.
Thank you for inviting me, Scott.
Great. So, Phil, let's before we really dig into some of the trends that are shaping our industry here, let's just start at the top here. What motivated you to start supermarketguru.com?
Well, to be honest with you, it's been a birth thing. My grandfather's a dairy farmer. My father is a food manufacturer, then a food broker, and went to school with an undergraduate degree in marketing and retail management, and then graduate degree in package design, and started designing all kinds of packaging for food, because in those days, food packages were pretty ugly. So that's what started everything. And then I started writing the Lempert Report as a bi-weekly newsletter, paper newsletter, if you remember those, that went out to about 400 people. And everything just grew from there. From that, went on to be the food editor for NBC's Today Show for a couple decades, and just decided that what consumers needed back then, and the internet was certainly not what it is today, was an honest, unbiased, unadvertising site where people could go and get the straight up about new food products, what trends are going there, where buyers from supermarkets could also look at new products and get our ratings on it. So really just trying to be in the center of a triangle, if you would, where one edge of the triangle are retailers, the other one is brands, then the other one is consumers. And what we try to do at Supermarket Guru is be in the middle and make sure everybody knows what everybody else is thinking and doing.
Awesome. You founded in 1994. I think I probably would have failed a trivia question on whether or not the internet was around in 1994. It's evolved, you've evolved, and it's certainly a must read for, as you mentioned, consumers, but anyone that's in the food and beverage industry. Staying up to date with the latest news, you do these great food reviews as well. So I hope people will subscribe to it through the newsletter as well. But today we want to pick your brain a little bit because I think it's safe to say that, I don't know, maybe 2018 is the year that your food shopping industry and experience is being disrupted.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
It's perhaps been a little bit of a last bastion of traditional shopping. Naturally with, the potential for food to spoil and stuff, it hasn't always lended itself to an easy move online with e-commerce, but, with smartphone apps, everything else, it's changing. And we want to try and get a little bit of insight from you, who's seen it evolve over the years, to try and understand what's it going to look like in 5 years. What are stores going to look like? What is that experience going to look like? Will there be stores? Maybe we'll talk about that a little bit. So we'll touch on a couple of those topics for our listeners. The digital transformation of the shopping experience, it was not digital for a while. And then, I think coupons was the first maybe litmus test for bringing digital capabilities and obviously then data mining, has clearly been something that's provided a lot of feedback for supermarkets. But all that kind of seems on the surface, right? If it really changed the experience for us, you know, shopping lists and apps that help you with shopping lists, again, kind of tiptoeing its way there. But now, obviously, with Amazon, you know, bringing its talents into the marketplace, things are changing. So when it comes specifically to digital, you know, smartphones, online, and e-commerce, what do you see, or let's say the three trends that are reshaping the shopping experience right now?
Well, let's take a step back for a second and remember that a lot of this technology has been around for a long time. IBM, I remember being at the IBM labs in North Carolina probably 15 years ago, and they were showing me things that, you know, still haven't come out. And it's really been the consumer and the industry that has held digital back, in my opinion. So, you know, now we're first starting to see consumers getting into it. And a lot of it has to do with certainly millennials and Generation Z who grew up with smartphones, who grew up with the internet, that they really don't have to recalibrate their brains on how to go grocery shopping. So I think that that's important. And also from a retailer standpoint, and you mentioned a lot of excellent points, it's been a very staid industry. And what we're seeing now is a whole different way of thinking about grocery. It used to be the model where a CEO started out as a bag boy, worked his way up the ladder, and, you know, that was the industry. Today, what we're seeing, because of folks like Amazon getting involved and other high-tech companies, cellular agriculture and in Silicon Valley and places like that, we're starting to see people who are graduating Harvard and Stanford and MIT coming into grocery. And that's cool. We've never been the cool kids on the block in grocery. Now we're starting to get a whole different way of thinking. And I think that when we look at these new people who have lived and breathed digital from birth, as well as upping the game as it relates to grocery shopping, you know, it's profound. And we haven't seen anything yet. What I think is the most important, which is something that we haven't seen full blast, is going to be automatic replenishment, where we've got, you know, the internet of home, if you would, where I've got a smart refrigerator and smart cupboards. There's scanners built into the side of the doors. The shelves are actually scales. So what I've done is I've gone online to whoever that retailer of choice is and told them, these are the products I never want to run out of. So every time I take some milk in and out of the refrigerator, it scans that barcode. It then also measures how much milk I've consumed. So it knows that within a day of when I'm going to run out of milk, it's automatically going to show up. So I think that from a digital standpoint, when we start to look at those kinds of technologies, it's fabulous. One of the steps to get there is certainly artificial intelligence. And whether you've got Alexa or OK Google or any of these devices, they're going to become probably the biggest supermarket source. Because what I can do is I can sit in my desk and I can just, I happen to love pistachios. I can just say to my device, you know, order me pistachios, and they'll be here within 2 hours. So that technology, that digital effort is really significant. I think that a lot of the technologies that we're seeing today, for example, you know, scan and go, where we're using our mobile devices and so on, that for me is 5 years old. You know, nobody wants to deal with that. We want it all to be easier and invisible. And I think the other part of digital that's so important is where we're starting to see intelligent search engines as it relates to food. So, for example, there's this company out of the UK that's working with Tesco called Spoon Guru. And what they do is they have all the attributes of products, of foods. And when somebody goes on Tesco's website and, you know, checks off that they're looking for a vegan, for example, before this, they might have come up with 100 different products that would do it. Because of this digital nature of taking all the all the images that are on the package, looking at all the ingredients, verifying so that it's 100% pure data, you'll come up with 23,000 products that are vegan. So I think those are the kinds of advantages, all those three examples that digital can really bring us to.
Mm. So how will food, so clearly, take a step back here. Clearly, the supermarkets will change. I think that they, you know, they'll look for everything, as you mentioned, from, just purely financial driven decisions, like making sure that products are always in stock on the shelves. And rather than someone at 2 a.m. needing to walk the shelves, they'll be able to say, hey, we're out of this, and it'll be on the truck tomorrow so that it can be there in the morning. That'll drive a lot of things. Consumers will drive. Because they will recognize that, as you said, and I think it's fascinating, if my refrigerator can determine that I only have one egg left, then, I'm almost harking back to the days of that you'll never have to ask your neighbor for an egg again, because it will, you know, perhaps show up or at the very least alert you that, hey, you're getting low, and it will know your habits that perhaps on Saturdays you cook eggs a lot because you have a little bit more time or something like that. But how can marketers, food and beverage marketers, adjust to this? Because, let's go 20 years ago, you had to go to the food store, right? And you went once a week, and maybe you had to go every now and then to pick something up, but you went once a week. And really your decisions were made based on perhaps two factors: the advertising that you saw, so your various brand impressions over the course of the weeks and months prior to, but then the packaging, right? It was just you went up and down the aisle and you just looked for what you needed, and whatever caught your eye or resonated with you, you purchased. And and to that end, marketers in that era, did their advertising, FSIs and stuff to support that, and then it came down to shelf space and location, right? If you're eye level, you're going to get purchased more. So now, if I use perhaps myself as an example, I still go to the food store once a week, but I probably only buy half my food there. Certainly all the perishables, but I've got two kids. They eat the same stuff every day, more or less. You surprise them in their lunchbox and you're not doing well. So, we get stuff delivered because I can tell you exactly how many of a certain granola bar we're going to eat every week. Mm-hmm. So half of my stuff shows up really on subscription most of the time. The other half is at the food store. So how are marketers going to adjust to this, given that that's a very, very different way of making decisions? And I might even argue it's different, more difficult to get me to switch. Because I'm not there to shake, maybe look at and hold and shake the box. I'm just, continually reordering, the cans of soup or the granola bars or the peanut butter or whatnot. So how do you see it that marketers are going to have to shift here?
Well, food and beverage marketers are in trouble for not only the reason that you're pointing out, but a lot of the iconic brands that our parents and grandparents grew up with, frankly, have failed us. They haven't evolved, and a lot of Generation Z and millennials don't see any difference between store brands and national brands. And as a result of that, we're seeing every retailer upping the quality of their store brands and the assortment. The perfect example is Aldi and Lidl, where 90% of what they have is under their own brand. And these two retailers are loved by millennials and the such, because, it costs you about half. And the quality is as good, if not superior, to a lot of the national brands. So, these food and beverage companies, these monoliths that we used to have running our food world, have really started to panic, which is why they've opened up incubators. They've bought other smaller companies. They're just trying to do everything they can to figure out the future. Now, to your point, Once you're on automatic replenishment, it's hard to switch somebody to another brand, which is why when we look at the internet, when we look at mobile, it's more important than ever before to build a relationship of your brand with a human being. It could be through YouTube. It could be through Facebook Live. But the rules have changed. You're right. You know, FSIs are not what they used to be. You pick up the Sunday FSI, and I'd say probably, less than 20% of what's in there is actually consumable. It could be some detergents and paper goods, and Princess Diana plates are still being sold. But there's not a lot of food out there. So it's really going to be up to that retailer to create a better shopping experience for us. And we've started to see that. We've started to see folks like Hy-Vee in the Midwest with their market grills, and every store has a retail dietitian that can help you. They've now also bought Wahlburger franchises, so they're going to have Wahlburgers within their stores as well. Mariano's in Chicago, great grocer on concept. In fact, in Chicago on Friday nights, it's the hot pickup place at the Mariano's Oyster Bars in the stores. So for the stores, it's all about building a relationship. And what all these brands are trying to do is figure out how to work with the stores, how to communicate to consumers, because at the same time, we have a lot of new upstart brands that are gaining traction with consumers that are not advertising on TV or in FSIs or in newspapers and just relying on social media. So they've got to think altogether different on how, you know, we can attract and build a relationship with a shopper. And what shoppers are looking for today is very different. It's not just about taste or the price of a product. It's what this company stands for. It's all about sustainability, transparency. When shoppers are starting to look at where a company invests its money, who owns the banks that invest their money, that's really telling. And it's becoming more challenging, especially for the big companies that are out there. And, you know, we're seeing more companies like Soulful, which, you know, donates oatmeal to a school or to a food bank every time somebody purchases it. You know, the Tom's model, the Tom's Shoes model. We're seeing more and more companies doing that, becoming involved in the community. And also, the other thing to recognize is that you don't have to be a national brand and be in every food store, whether it's a dollar store or a supermarket or a health chain, to be successful. You have these smaller companies that are very happy just selling in California or the Northeast part of the country, and they do very well. So all the mentality has shifted.
I can only imagine some of the conversations going on.
Oh, absolutely. And then, you know, talking about conversations, look at what's happened in breakfast cereal, because breakfast cereal has really fallen down. You know, the conversation of that brand manager that goes up to the CEO's office and says, I want to take the artificial colors out of Lucky Charms. And, you know, that CEO, who's probably, you know, between over 60, is sitting there saying, wait a minute. What are you saying? You know, we want our cereals to glow in the dark. And just that conversation about health and nutrition, what ingredients are allowed? I mean, those are going through the boardrooms, you know, a mile a minute. And you still have a lot of skeptics that are sitting there saying, you know, no, this is a fad. People really don't care where their food comes from. I can tell you that it's not a fad and it's not a trend. It's a reality.
Well, it's still a little bit passe to, you know, I don't know. You know, I think it's the hobby horse of many to bash millennials. Mm-hmm. I think companies are making a big mistake with that, because they're, you know, they don't care about this. They don't care. Yeah, that's right. You know, that's what they care about. Right? They're the next spenders.
Yeah, keep in mind that millennials are the most passionate generation ever about food. You know, we shouldn't be bashing them. We should be listening to them and learning from them to really understand what the future is going to hold. I mean, you look at a company like Beyond Meat or Impossible Foods making these faux burgers, if you would. This never would have flown 15 years ago with the baby boomers. Not even close. Millennials, Generation Z, they're willing to experiment. They're not stuck in the rut of what used to be. So they're pushing these companies forward. We're now Impossible Foods, you know, I believe, is in something like 1,000 restaurants. Beyond Meat is in something like 3,000 supermarkets. This is huge.
I can say that. I can only imagine the executives insisting that millennials need to buy a $5 box of cereal in 20 minutes to eat it in the morning.
Exactly.
So shifting gears just a little bit, because we care about taste here at Chef's Best. And so I want to get some of your thoughts on that. We align with a lot of companies that are interested, of course, in marketing their value along taste lines. I think we're honest in that there's certainly been a shift towards putting your marketing dollars or at the very least your packaging space towards talking about natural ingredients and so on and so forth. And I like to say that I feel like we've reached some sort of peak organic here where, it used to be a differentiator where you could say you were natural or organic, but once everyone is saying it, whether it's factual or not or accurate is irrelevant here, but once everyone's saying it, you no longer have that as a differentiator. So I'm curious about taste and where you see it mattering. And I want to be clear here that in no way am I asking you to promote Chef's Best or anything about taste. If you think taste doesn't matter, then please say it. But
I'm No. Taste,
particularly with millennials, where does taste fall in here? Because I feel like, to some extent, you're talking about how an oatmeal company will donate oatmeal. Wonderful, and it's great. But it's still something you want to find some pleasure in, right?
Taste is number one. I've been reviewing, food products, whether it's on the Today Show or our website, for close to 30 years. And our algorithm has always put taste as number one. That's critical. You can be as healthy as anything, but if it doesn't taste good, nobody's going to buy it. And I'll give you a very current example. Kale became this hot ingredient. Well, what really started selling was baby kale, because the kale itself is something that every supermarket had, but nobody bought it. And it was used in the deli case as decoration because, frankly, it wouldn't go bad for weeks. It's really pretty tough stuff. So people started getting in on the kale craze. And then all of a sudden they said, oh, this doesn't taste so good. And then baby kale really started to replace it. So taste is critical. There's no question about it. And to your point, to have a differentiator is critical, which is why we're starting to see more people sampling their products, going back to sampling than ever before, whether it's sampling, at pop-ups, sampling in supermarkets, sending samples out to people. That's critical. And for millennials, what I've said for a long time is millennials are the generation who wake up every morning and never want to eat the same thing twice in their lifetime. So as a result of that, they've pushed for innovation. They've pushed to have different combinations. At the Fancy Food Show in San Francisco just a few weeks ago, you saw combinations that were unbelievable and delicious. I went to the Wisconsin cheese area, matter of fact, and you can't get more boring than Wisconsin cheese. I mean, you've got cheddar, you've got Swiss, and I grew up in a cheese family, so it's okay for me to say that. So I went to this one booth, and this guy only makes cheddar, and he has over 100 different varieties of cheddar, from different kinds of milks, aged differently, but also different flavor combinations, putting mango chips in cheddar and things like that. So I think that taste has become more important than ever before, number one. Number two is what I really think is because of the internet, because of the amount of recipes that are on the internet, what we're seeing is exposure to more different kinds of cuisines than we've ever seen before. Somebody takes a picture of a really cool poke and puts it on Instagram, and all of a sudden we've got, 12 different poke franchises, that are sweeping the nation. So we're seeing a more adventurous palate than we did with the baby boomers, than we did with Generation X. And that's pushing companies to have more and more innovation. And again, taste is always going to be key. You can have all the other attributes, but if your product tastes lousy, nobody's going to buy it.
Right. I should point out too, Phil, that there are two poke locations within 1 mile of my suburban home and a third one coming next year.
Yep. And here in Santa Monica, on Main Street in Santa Monica, that has, I want to say, 7 blocks to it, maybe 8 blocks to it. There are two that are already open and two more under construction.
We're going to reach peak poke pretty soon.
Exactly.
But to your point, I think let's break that down. Though it's reflective of a few things, I believe, and tell me if I'm right or wrong and add to this.
Sure.
One, as you said, more sophisticated palette. I mean, can you imagine 30 years ago, people putting Misago and you know, edamame and everything else on their food? I don't think
absolutely
so.
Not.
People traveling more, you know, ethnic diversity, everything is affecting that. I think where people are just exposed and getting more, but it's also that customization. So I want to talk about that a little bit, because if you look at, you know, we're in a, some people say we're in a restaurant bubble. I don't know. Not sure. I'm enjoying it, whatever it may be. But, certainly there is, at least in my eyes, success is being found when you can customize your food, whether that's make your own pizza, you know, Chipotle, the poke, you could say, you know, this is what I want on my food. I have my own taste. That doesn't really translate that well, though, to the supermarket, I feel, because I think there's two options right now to eat at home, right? There's, well, that's oversimplified, but you get my point here. It's two options. You either buy something pre-made, you know, in a freezer aisle, perhaps, or you make something from scratch. The challenge, of course, there is, you know, something that is purchased might have a lot of salt in it, and, you know, it's been frozen, so it's not ideal. And then the alternate route there is increasingly a challenge because, you know, families and dynamics have changed. Who the heck has 45 minutes with three kids to make a meal at 6 p.m., right? So how are we going to marry this? Because we've got a desire to customize, right? It's a I want what I want world now, whether it's 400, you know, I want what channel on the TV or, right. You know, it's all, everything's customized to what you want. Yet supermarkets can't really do that. So can we attempt to reconcile that?
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, there's just a couple comments. First of all, you know, frozen is new. Frozen has more new products in it than are ever before, that are healthy, that are lower in sodium, that are absolutely terrific. And it took the frozen food industry a long time to catch up to this. It took them a long time to make those changes nutritionally and packaging-wise and ingredient-wise that they had to. And I think there are more choices. Certainly, you have frozen, you have it from scratch. You can now get meal kits in supermarkets. You don't have to go to Blue Apron and have them delivered, but most supermarkets now have their own meal kits. If you look at what Walmart just announced about 10 days ago, where, you know, they now have, in addition to their meal kits, one-step prepared food. So it's just heat and eat, but a much higher quality than they've ever had before. So to your point, you know, those are not customizable. But what is customizable in a supermarket has to do with 3D printing. There's no reason why. And you know, the first time I saw food being 3D printed was at South by Southwest, and it was Oreo cookies, and it was probably about 4 or 5 years ago. There's no reason why supermarkets will not have 3D printers, a bank of 3D printers. So let's say you go up to, you know, whatever the counter is, and you check off on an iPad or on your iPhone, you know, what ingredients you want in a bowl or anything else. It's going to be sent right to that 3D printer, and it's going to make it for you on the spot, whether it's a cake, whether it's, you know, a custom bowl and so on. So technology is really going to fast track this whole customization process beyond what we think of, you know, beyond the Burger King, you know, have it your way, leave off the pickle for me and give me two extra pieces. You know, that's where customization probably started from, but we're a long way past that now.
Wow. Now that you've mentioned 3D printed food, I think that's that's the end of the podcast. I don't know. What does that look like? What is 3D printed? Is that what I heard? 3D printed food?
Yeah. They're for sale for consumers as well as commercial applications. And basically, I've tasted pizza off it, tasted the Oreos off it, other cakes. They're machines that look like computer printers, if you would. And instead of ink cartridges, there are cartridges for food ingredients. And it just goes down in layers the same way you would have a home printer. And home 3D printers, especially for a lot of chocolate shapes and molds and so on, started about $1,000. So if you're really a chocoholic and you want to eat something different every day, you can just use a CAD drawing on your computer screen and send it to your 3D printer and have, you know, a chocolate, profile of yourself, of your face come out and then bite the head off.
Wow. There's a vengeful factor there. So you're a huge, huge wealth of information. I want to ask one more question.
And then, of course.
Certainly anyone that's enjoying this conversation should be checking out supermarketguru.com if they're not already, where these topics and many more are covered literally on a daily basis. But perhaps as a final takeaway to any consumers that are out there, what are maybe one or two apps, I'm using that term loosely because, web-based or whatnot, but one or two tools that you find that are really unique and stand out, because I think there's a lot that are out there right now, thousands I would wager, but have you come across maybe one or two that you say, you know what, now that actually is going to help people and improve their experience?
Yes. Well, the one that I personally don't live without, and I felt this way for years, is Seafood Watch. And that's from the Monterey Bay Aquarium. And that's a free app. And basically, we all know that seafood is good for us from a health standpoint, and it's more affordable than some other proteins. But seafood has, I don't know, 5,000-6,000 different species. And there are some species that come from different parts of the world that you don't want to consume from a food safety standpoint, or they're an endangered species. So for me, Seafood Watch is a must-have to have on your mobile device as you're shopping. Also, take a look at whatever supermarket you happen to be shopping at, what their app is, because very often you have certain chains like Hy-Vee in the Midwest that has a terrific app that can offer all kinds of information and saving money. I'm one of those iPhone freaks that probably have 200 apps on my phone, all 99% of which are food. I tend to not like a lot of the recipe apps that are out there. There are exceptions to that rule, but what I've fallen in love with is my Alexa Home, where right in the kitchen I can call up a recipe from three or four different sources. All recipes is probably my favorite from a recipe standpoint, and then just scroll through and see which one I want to make for dinner, and it's all right there.
I'm literally filled downloading Seafood Watch right now. I'm glad I spoke with you just for that reason, if nothing else.
Good. I want to keep you healthy.
I was not aware of that one. So we mentioned supermarketguru.com. How else can folks follow you and get all this great information from you?
Sure. Well, we're obviously on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, and every Wednesday, except for occasionally if I'm traveling, but every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Pacific time, we do our food reviews live on Facebook Live. So it's a great way to see what's new. We rate them on an 8-point system. Again, as I said, taste being number one, value number two, but sustainability, the ingredients, the nutritional information, the packaging of it, if they're giving back to their community. So you can check us out on Facebook at Supermarket Guru, Twitter at Phil Lempert, and certainly supermarketguru.com.
Awesome. Well, encourage everyone to do that. Phil, I want to thank you for joining us. If we're being honest here, I think this could have turned into about a 5-hour conversation.
Anytime. Happy to help.
The potential for dietitians to be in the store assisting people alone, I think, is worthy of its own study and discussion. I think that would be a great idea. I mean,
Love to do it. And in fact, we started something about 7 years ago called the Retail Dietitians Business Alliance. And it really helped. And we've got some great stories at retaildietitians.com, where you can really read as a consumer, you know, what some of these dietitians are doing in their stores and give you a lot of great ideas.
Awesome. Super. Well, Phil, thanks for joining us. I know you're a very busy man, and we'll keep monitoring you at supermarketguru.com and the Limpert Report and all your various newsletters that are, getting really great information out there.
Thank you, Scott. And thank you for doing such a great job with Chef's Best as well.
Thank you for joining us on Just a Taste, a Chef's Best production. Join us again next time as we talk to more experts in marketing, retail, and production in the food and beverage industry. You can always visit us at chefsbest.com to learn more.